Welcome to Q Ideas with Gabe Lyons.
Q is about conversation.
If we're really concerned about ending poverty, we've got to be more concerned about creating justice.
Our cultural products as Christians need to both defy and resonate with the culture.
And God's doing amazing things. His church is expanding. His church is growing.
It's not what's the purpose of my life. It's what is the purpose that's been assigned.
Stay curious. Think well. Advance good. This is Q.
Hi, and welcome again to Q Ideas with Gabe Lyons. I'm Paul Perreault from Faith Radio, and we're glad you're joining us again this week. Recently, Q Ideas hosted numerous Q Commons events throughout the United States and the world. Through the wonders of modern technology, each local event got to hear some great national thought leaders on the theme of healing our divided nation. But then locally, those attending heard some great local thought leaders addressing the same issue. This was quite intentional because the reality is, if there's going to be change, it has to start locally. Gabe, you introduced a new initiative at Q Commons that we'll talk about a little later on in the show, but on the topic of being local and knowing your community, this week you wanted to share a special message from a recent Q conference. Tell us about it.
The talk that we've decided to focus on this time was rated one of our top talks at our most recent Q conference. And the title of the talk is called Divided States. And we asked the question, how do America's rival regions explain our differences? And it's very American focused, but you're going to get a history of the different regions that make up the American life. And the author of this, Colin Woodard, he's an award-winning author and journalist. He's written some amazing pieces and books. And this particular book is getting some incredible praise because he really breaks down how the American society, how our country is broken really into 11 different states. So you might think, hey, America's 50 states. No, Colin says, no, there's 11 different regions, and they've always been here since the population started to form and build and people started to settle throughout this country. And when you understand these regions, you can start to explain a lot about how people get along, how they think. In the midst of the Trump election, he was one of the few people who could see the Trump election happening and Trump winning because he understood the regions. He understood the electorate. He looked at it in a different way that wasn't only state by state, but that combined different regions and counties and states. And you'll be interested to hear that a lot hasn't changed over the last several hundred years of the American experiment and the settling that took place, that a lot of opinions, a lot of perceptions, a lot of the ways that there's these entrenched ideas have settled in still are a part of American life. And so I want you to hear this talk in the context of knowing that on Thursday night, people are coming together in their cities to wrestle with difficult conversations, topics, but also to find a way forward together. And I think when you hear his talk, it's going to help you have an empathy, an understanding for your neighbor, for people who may be moved from a different region to your region and think differently than you. How do we grapple with that? And how can we better understand it? I think you're going to be fascinated by it. Let's listen in now to Colin Woodard.
Thank you all, and thank you for Q for inviting me. I'm going to be speaking about American Nations, which is a book on North American regionalism and the vital importance it plays in understanding our history, our national identity, and indeed our current political cleavages, which are geographic even as they are ideological. Now, I think we all know that regionalism is important, that there are red states and blue states and never the twain shall meet, that there was a civil war and there's some place called the South that's supposedly still fighting it, that presidential candidates are supposed to say one set of things to their party faithful when they arrive in the campaign trail in New Hampshire, and then 2 weeks later are supposed to say a completely different set of things when they speak to the faithful of the same party in South Carolina. Even in this Tea Party era, Maine and Mississippi might as well be on separate planets in terms of general assumptions on religious values, political priorities, the correct role of government, the relationship between church and state, even the meaning of such key words in the American lexicon as freedom or liberty or how we define the American identity and values. Indeed, we're no more a united culture, a united nation, than Europe is. Our component cultures are more diverse and share fewer values than any two European Union nation states today. But we can't talk about these critical differences in any meaningful way because we don't have the right map. Well, what do you mean? About? We hear about regions all the time. I mean, you see polling data, you know, and by region and whether people like Pepsi or Coke by region. But the problem is all of the discussion about regionalism follows definitions that follow state lines and divide the country along the federal government's, you know, census domains into a Northeast and a Midwest and a West and a South. But this approach, particularly following state lines, distorts and dilutes the true role of the regional cultures. It misses the actual cultural fissures, which are historically based, have been consistent through the centuries, and rarely respect state or even international boundaries. Now, again, I think we all, when we think about it, know that the state boundaries don't capture something about regional cultures. I mean, anybody here from Maryland? I mean, Marylanders know that there are three Marylands, and you can get discussions between them as to exactly where the border between the three are. Texans know that Austin is the state capital, but that San Antonio and Dallas and Houston are the hubs of three very different Texases. There's that coastal strip from Central California all the way up through Washington State, Oregon, and even British Columbia that tends to agree on matters political and cultural with each other and completely disagrees with the interiors of their own states and provinces. There's upstate and downstate Illinois. There's even that great quote from James Carville, the Democratic strategist who helped Bill Clinton get elected the first time, the Ragin' Cajun, who said he was describing to a political neophyte how you win statewide office in Pennsylvania. And he said, what you have to understand is there's Philadelphia and Pittsburgh and Alabama in between. And if he was talking about the uplands of Alabama, he was actually on pretty solid historical and ethnocultural ground. The people of Missouri can't even agree on a regional basis how to pronounce the name of the state. So clearly, state boundaries are not capturing something. And yet, in times of uncertainty and discord, we Americans have this tendency to seek solace in the works of the founding fathers, hoping that if we return to their ideals, if we understood and followed their intent, we could find our misplaced sense of common purpose, restore our civic strength, and return the Union to unity. But this effort is complicated by the simple and rather obvious, when you think about it, fact that the men who came together to confront a common enemy in 1775 and to build a more enduring alliance in 1787 to 89 were not the country's founders, but rather the founders' great and great, great, and great, great, great grandchildren. And those real original founders shared very little in common in terms of purpose and intent and ideals. Indeed, most of our true regional cultures date back to the 17th and early 18th centuries. The original clusters of North American colonies were settled by people from distinct regions of the British Isles and from France and the Netherlands and Spain, each of which had their own religious and political and ethnographic characteristics. For generations, these discrete Euro-American cultures developed in remarkable isolation from one another, consolidating their own cherished principles and fundamental values, and expanding across the eastern half of the continent in nearly exclusive settlement bands. Now, some of these regional cultures champion individualism. Others, utopian social reform. Some believe themselves to be guided by divine purpose. Others champion freedom of conscience and inquiry. Some embrace an explicit Anglo-Protestant identity. Others, ethnic and religious pluralism. Some valued equality and democratic participation in politics. Others, deference to a traditional aristocratic social order modeled in the slave states of classical antiquity. Throughout the colonial period in the early republic, they saw each other as competitors for land, for settlers, for capital, and even as enemies, taking opposite sides in the English Civil War of the 1640s, in the American Revolution, in the War of 1812. Indeed, nearly all of the regional cultures you see on the map behind me right now would consider leaving the Union in the 80-year period following the Battle of Yorktown. And two, of course, went to do so tragically in the 1860s. You can also see the south-to-north settlement that occurred on the southern rim of the country, from New Spain extending northward into their frontier. So the point is that there's never been an America, but rather several Americas. And there are 11 today. You can see them here on a county-level resolution. Now, there isn't time today in the Q format to describe them all to you, so let me briefly sketch out two that bring many of the cultural cleavages we face into sharp relief. Let's start with one in dark blue up there, the area marked Yankeedom. Now, this is a culture that started with the Puritan migration to Massachusetts Bay, a culture founded by radical Calvinists as a new Zion, a light on the hill. And since the outset, it has put great emphasis on perfecting earthly society through social engineering, individual self-denial for the common good, and the aggressive assimilation of outsiders. It has prized education, intellectual achievement, and community rather than individual empowerment, and broad citizen participation in politics and government, the latter seen as the public shield against the machinations of grasping aristocrats and other would-be tyrants. Now, let me describe to you what you're seeing on the map so you can understand what this is sort of all about. So the Puritans came to Massachusetts Bay. They arrived in the 1630s. They then annexed the old colony of the Pilgrims on Cape Cod and the Royalist settlements in Maine, sucked New Hampshire and Connecticut into their orbits. And then, when the Dutch, who had settled New York City in the Hudson Valley, were defeated in the 1670s, a new creation in the British colonial sphere called New York was being created. But there was a problem. You remember back to your high school textbooks and the like, that each colony on the colonial map looked like the colonies today, except most of them had this strip as wide as the colony extending all the way to the Pacific Ocean, because they all said, hey, wherever the next ocean is, we don't know where it is yet, but we claim a strip as wide as our colony all the way out there. And Massachusetts had such a claim. And so when New York was created, they said, no, millions of acres of this Massachusettsian-wide strip of New York State belong to us. Well, a compromise was made. New York became New York. But over those millions of acres, Massachusetts, the Commonwealth itself, was given title to all that land by way of compensation and settled it with Massachusetts-based land companies, settling with Massachusetts settlers, usually decamping entire towns and deploying New England-style villages with their public schools, their town greens, and their congregational meeting houses from the outset, which is why so much of that parts of upstate New York resemble New England itself. This same scenario was played out again, if you look at Connecticut, at the blue part, of Ohio, the blue part up against Lake Erie, that's the Western Reserve of Connecticut, because Connecticut had a Connecticutian-wide strip all the way to the Pacific, and when the new Ohio Territory was created, they claimed it, and the same compromise played out, causing the Western Reserve and only the Western Reserve of Connecticut to be colonized in the New England fashion. Fast forward a generation to the Michigan Territory being created, and the first settlers, the territorial governors, the founders of the lumber industry, and those who came together to write the state constitution, the Constitutional Convention, were all from the Western Reserve of Ohio, the Yankees settled upstate of New York, or New England itself, which provided four of the territory's first five governors. Same thing in Wisconsin and Minnesota as you pass on further. So what this is the early settlers bringing the ideas, institutions, assumptions, and stories about who we are, fundamental religious values, and all the stuff that makes up culture, they set down, sort of formatting the hard drive, as it were, for everyone who came later.
We'll have more from Colin Woodard in just a moment. You're listening to Q Ideas with Gabe Lyons, and as we talk about healing our divided nation and working locally for the common good, Gabe, at the recent Q Commons event, you spoke about a new initiative that you and the Q team are excited about. Tell us about it.
We're excited about a new campaign that we're inviting you into. 25,000 people have just joined up with this idea that we want to be responsible and take our own initiative to be a part of healing the divide that we see in our societies. We're using the hashtag #UpToUs, and the idea is that this is up to us. It's not up to anybody else. It's not up to government leaders. It's not up to just academic and institutional leaders. It's not just up to the church or religious leaders. It's actually up to us. And so as part of this campaign, what we're asking you to do is three things. The first is we want you to speak up. We want you to tell others that you're a part of this. We want you to let them know, share, post, that you're pledging to lead in a different way, that you want to be part of the solution. The second thing we're asking you to do is meet up. Meet up with somebody who's different than you. In person, eye to eye, talk to somebody, learn from them who have a different perspective from you. They disagree with you, maybe politically, maybe they're of a different race, maybe they have a bias that you don't share. And by getting time together, you're just going to listen and learn and demonstrate and model how to lead better conversations in a divided world. The third thing we're asking you to do is to listen up. When you gather people in your homes, around the table, maybe a small group conversation, or this Thanksgiving, or over the holidays, when you get together, listen to people's stories and perspective. Let's ask better questions. And we believe if we do that, we will actually be part of the healing. We won't be blaming somebody else for the problems we see in our society. We'll actually be taking responsibility by saying, it's up to us.
Thanks, Gabe. This is an exciting challenge, and if you want to learn more, go to uptous.qideas.org. Again, that's uptous.qideas.org to learn how you can join in and be a part. Now let's get back to Colin Woodard as he helps us to understand the different regions of our divided nation.
Let's pivot to a very different culture. Greater Appalachia Here's a culture starting up there in the dark red, which was founded in the early 18th century by wave upon wave of settlers from the war-ravaged borderlands of the British Isles, of Northern Ireland, Northern England, and the Scottish Lowlands. Now, Appalachia has been lampooned by generations of writers and screenwriters as the home of hillbillies and rednecks, but it's really a transplanted culture formed in a state of near constant danger and upheaval and characterized by a warrior ethic and a deep commitment to personal sovereignty and individual liberty. Intensely suspicious of lowland aristocrats and Yankee social engineers alike, Appalachia shifted its alliances on the federal stage between whomever appeared to be the greatest threat to its freedom. Since Reconstruction, it's been in an alliance with the Deep South in an effort to undo the federal government's ability to override local preferences. But in the Civil War itself, Appalachia was on the Union side, with breakaway Unionist uprising in eastern Tennessee and northern Alabama, and more successfully, West Virginia. And this culture arrived originally in south-central Pennsylvania at the very top right part of that swath on the map and proceeded down the wagon road, the great wagon road through the uplands of the South, extending down into the backcountry of places like Virginia and South Carolina, on into the uplands not only of the South, but the Ozarks, the Texas Hill Country, and into Oklahoma, and another spur coming through from Virginia and Kentucky and rafting down the Ohio to settle the lower tiers of the lower Midwest. Western states like Ohio and Indiana and Illinois. And you can see how having those two very different cultures with different approaches might lead to a fractious federation. Indeed, these two cultures illustrate the fundamental and extremely disruptive cleavages in American life. The differing and contradictory interpretations about what freedom means, what building a free society entails. Because the American political conversation centers on how to protect and further our liberal democratic experiment. And I'm using liberal here in its original Gladstonian sense, as in the second part of that phrase, neoliberal, the aspirational pursuit of a society where all individuals can be free. The problem is, we don't agree on how to do that. And the regional cultures, like Yankeedom and Greater Appalachia, have contradictory traditions and ideas in this regard. Is freedom ultimately about maximizing the autonomy of the individual, about personal sovereignty and a lack of restraints, especially, but not exclusively, from government? If we had less government and less taxes and less regulation, is it not axiomatic that each of us would be more free? Or is it that freedom is about building and maintaining the infrastructure and institutions of a free society, the schools and parks, roads and bridges, public universities, libraries, clinics, and private associations that act as the leveling mechanisms to ensure that each person has a fair shot of achieving their potential and being meaningfully free, regardless of the circumstances of their birth? Is it a shared endeavor, a social project, a cultivation of a Republican citizenry? Because there's two sides to freedom, ultimately. There's individual liberty and the common good, and they're both really important. Because if you stray too far and too extreme in the pursuit of one or the other, you wind up in tyranny. In the individualistic form, the oligarchic variety, which is illustrated in late 20th century El Salvador, or Guatemala, or Honduras, where the 10 families, or the 8 families, or the 12 families, all in caps, have maximized their freedom and control the land and all the stuff, and the police and the courts and the army, and kill anybody who gets in their way. Or you can have the Orwellian form of tyranny, like Hitler's Germany or Stalin's Soviet Union, where the keepers of the common good criminalize dissent and wrong thinking and murder millions in an effort to cleanse the nation of the disloyal or the dangerous. The fact is, which American character argues, maximizing freedom's potential requires finding the sweet spot between individual liberty and the common good, a place where those two essential aspects of freedom are in equilibrium. And for several decades now, we've plunged towards an extreme individualism, the book argues, in a way that's destabilized communities, undermined social trust, and foreclosed the American dream to millions. But back to the regional cultures themselves. Their effect on history and society have been profound. This map is echoed in the battle lines of the English Civil War and the American Revolution, and in the debates in the Constitutional Convention and their voting patterns, and in the great votes leading up to the U.S. Civil War, and the culture wars of the 1960s, and most every hotly contested presidential election in our history. Check it out. You can't really see anything if you look at a blue state, red state map. You got to look at a blue county, red county map. And, you know, check out. You can see Yankeedom popping there all the way down to the Western Reserve of Ohio. You can see the left coast outlined against the interiors of its states and provinces. You can see a monochrome throughout Tidewater in the deep south. Oh, and I haven't messed with the colors. Red really is Republican and blue really is Democrat, because this isn't a recent presidential election. This is the 1916 showdown between Woodrow Wilson and Charles Hughes. Consider the 2008 map will look rather familiar, just the colors are reversed. Trying to understand American political history through parties is a fool's errand, because the parties come and go and indeed can reverse polarity, what they stand for in constituencies, which Democrats and Republicans have over the past century. So you have to look beyond that. You can also see a couple differences here. You can see that the South is no longer, the Deep South and Tidewater are no longer a monochrome single color, and that also you can see El Norte, the Spanish settled zone, starting to pop out in a separate color from the interior West. That's because between 1916 and 2008, African Americans and Hispanic people could exercise the franchise. Unfortunately, in the Deep South and Tidewater, those tend to be majority African American counties, because in these regions, political loyalties and race are still closely correlated. You can see again in the 2012, you see very much the same pattern. And not only 2012, even the Democratic primaries this past year. Here's a county map. Green are the counties in the Democratic primaries that Bernie Sanders won. Yellow are those that Clinton won. And it's not just elections that you see these things in. It's social issues. Here's Proposition 8, that 2000 referendum on gay marriage in California. Red counties supported same-sex marriage. Green ones opposed. It's left coast against the far west in El Norte. It's also health statistics. Here's the diabetes rates from the CDC by county. Here you can see that the Deep South and Greater Appalachia have a significant problem. Here's where the uninsured live by county, with reds being the highest levels of uninsured. Notice the regional variations in this map. Within states in places like Virginia and Ohio and Louisiana and California, despite the fact that insurance policies are set at the state level. It also profoundly affected 19th century immigration waves. This, also from the Census Bureau, is by county the percentage of people reporting that they were foreign-born in 1900. Notice, you know, the darker it is, the higher the percentage of people were foreign-born. Notice that nobody in that wave came to the Deep South, Tidewater, and Greater Appalachia, which further reinforced demographic and identity differences between these regional cultures. It also affected the distribution of religious traditions. Here from the Census Bureau again are the dominant religions today. Red's Baptist. That green little belt you see along the Midlands is Methodist. Gray is Mormon. Here's a detailed map of American dialects today, compiled well after the book was done. These are how people speak now. And despite immigration and mass media and the like, notice that the major domains that are set up here by Rick Ashman's much disseminated internet project follow many of the fissures in the American nation settlement patterns. And indeed, it even affects genetics. Even this isn't a work about genetics. The background, a group of people had a study in Nature just in February, the scientific journal Nature, where they took 770,000 genome samples of people and they matched them to genealogies to trace backwards the settlement patterns in the U.S., to reverse engineer where families came from generation to generation. And again, you can see the fissures matching the map in something produced 7 years after I wrote the book. So, I'm going to leave you with this taste of American nations and its paradigm, and I thank Hugh for having me and for all of you for your kind attention. Thank you very much.
Wasn't that fascinating to just hear Colin? And again, as I know it's hard on a podcast to do, he had several slides that really conveyed visually these regions and helped you see maybe where you live, what region are you a part of. And it was a lot of information, I know, in an 18-minute talk, but he did a fabulous job of helping us start to understand and grapple with this. You can go to qideas.org this week and actually watch this talk, see those slides, share it with friends. I think this creates quite a great conversation for many of us who are trying to understand the dynamics of American life and what many feel like is a new American moment. And I think when you listen to Colin, you go, man, this has kind of existed for a long time. There's been a lot of these divides in American life. But in addition to that, check out his book, American Nations, which really goes in depth even further than what he could do in this talk on these 11 rival regional cultures in North America, but also his previous book, American Character, A History of the Epic Struggle Between Individual Liberty and the Common Good. And as you do that, I think you're going to appreciate that it takes people like each of us, citizens, coming together to be a part of solving problems. And as I talked backstage with Colin Woodard about his next project, he was so inspired by what we're doing at Q, because what he's trying to do is tell the story of how sustained commitment by leaders in their city over many, many years is actually the only thing that creates change. We can't just see ourselves as entrenched, that there is no way for us to get along, for these rival cultures and rival mentalities to start to work together. But he says, no, there is a way. There's a historically proven way. And it's when leaders in communities over a sustained period of time commit that they're going to work together and they're going to find common ground and they're going to be a part of moving progress forward together. That's exactly what you're doing. As part of this Q community, you're the type of person who's thinking that way, who's leading this way. And our countries, that wherever you live, your city, whether it's international or not, is a place that needs that kind of leadership today. In a moment when a lot of people are backing away from leadership because there's a cost to it, there's people that are going to take shots at you, there's people who are going to disagree with you, we need to have courage to lead forward because we have something to offer to the world that the world's searching for and is more aware of now than maybe it has been for many decades. So let's do this together. Let's be a part of these continued conversations. Let's keep growing. Let's keep learning together. And let's move forward inspired by what's happening, that people are leading, that at least in 150 locations, can be encouraged to know that thousands of people are gathering because they do care about moving virtue forward. So until next time, pray with us, join with us this week, and we'll look forward to continuing the learning together. This show is made possible in partnership with Faith Radio and Northwestern Media.
Thank you for listening to the Q Ideas with Gabe Lyons podcast. These conversations are available because of listener support. You can make your gift now at myfaithradio.com. To avoid missing future editions of Q Ideas with Gabe Lyons, subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or on your podcast player. And thank you for sharing this audio link with a friend and growing the impact of Q Ideas with Gabe Lyons.